Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. Public drug use is a concern in cities across the nation. The usual approach of using police to move people along, make petty arrests, and otherwise harass people has never stopped people from using drugs. For the past few decades, cities around the world have had success with a different approach, safe consumption sites. For the October installment of its speaker series, the Institute for Addiction Science at the University of Southern California featured Alex Kral, Ph.D. Dr. Kral is a distinguished fellow, behavioral health and criminal justice at RTI International, and an epidemiologist with expertise in community-based research with urban poor populations and drug policy. His policy and evaluation research has included syringe services programs, overdose education and naloxone distribution programs, and supervised consumption site programs. Dr. Kral is currently principal investigator and co-investigator on several studies of the relationship between substance use, criminal legal involvement, infectious diseases and overdose, and federal and state drug policies, and he's authored or co-authored more than 190 articles in peer-reviewed journals. Dr. Kral's talk was entitled Overdose Prevention Sites, Global and Domestic Research, Policy, and Implementation.
As the title says up here, I'm going to be talking really about overdose prevention sites, going through the global and domestic research, policy, and implementation of these sites. And figured I would start, see if I can hit the right buttons here, just with a brief little introduction of sort of where do we place overdose prevention sites. They're really within harm reduction. And when we think about harm reduction, we're really talking about a set of practical strategies and ideas that are aimed at reducing negative consequences associated with drug use. Doing that client-directed, doing it non-judgmental, doing it a non-punitive way, and really coming up with practical strategies and interventions. These principles and the kinds of work that's happened over the years has really evolved. And I think the first thing that's really important for everyone to think about is that every single harm reduction service that we have seen or that has happened has really first been conceptualized by and implemented by people who use drugs themselves, and usually in hostile, unsanctioned environments. Some of the initial strategies focused on some practical low threshold things like syringe service programs or drug checking strips. And it's really evolved to a more explicit focus over the last couple of decades on centering and empowering people who use drugs. The naloxone distribution programs are certainly part of that. The drug users unions, both in Europe and now they've been starting in the United States lately as well. These overdose prevention sites, which we're going to be talking about today, and also community-based drug checking programs, the drug testing programs as well. But I think it's also good to think about the fact that these programs really are under attack, and they are under attack because the people who that they're trying to serve are under attack, right? There's a lot of stigma associated with drug use, and really every harm reduction intervention that's out there has been met by really a series that starts with first law enforcement having active prosecution of what it is, whether it be needle exchange programs or now the overdose prevention programs we're going to talk about today. And then that's kind of led to, after a few years, some local to then maybe state and hopefully federal kind of turning a blind eye. So they're not actively prosecuting, but they're actually like, okay, we're now going to actively turn a blind eye to the fact that this harm reduction intervention is happening in our community or our state. And then with time comes these sort of local quasi-legal kind of legislation and funding and in some of the sort of more progressive cities. And then finally you get to kind of state legislation, and after state legislation, state funding comes after that, and generally, and maybe even some federal funding with restrictions after that. But this process generally for each of these interventions is like two decades in the United States, like from then starting something and going through this whole cycle of all these various things, takes like 20, 25 years. I mean, you look at strange service programs, for example, which started in the late 80s, they didn't really have federal funding sort of towards the end of this, you know, until the last like 5, 6, 7 years. It takes a long time for that to happen. And the same is true for all of these things. And so this is a way to kind of look at it. And then once you kind of get this established, then you get sort of the last part of this, which is you will get local reactionary legislation, defunding, active prosecution again in some places as well, and sort of becomes a cyclical thing. But I wanted to address this as that's how things are going in general, to look at that cycle. When we're talking then, like, where are we at with overdose prevention sites and what are they, what's the state of them? And that's what I'm going to be focusing on today. And essentially what an overdose prevention site is a place where people can use pre-obtained drugs. So they're getting drugs from somewhere else. They can't get them on site. And then they use them there under the supervision of somebody who basically is equipped with oxygen or naloxone at minimum. That's like the sort of bare bones what an overdose prevention site is. So they can help essentially reverse their overdose in case there is an overdose right then and there. Now, there's a lot more that comes to it, but at the sort of, if you strip it down to that, you know, these have been called safe consumption sites or drug consumption rooms, which is what Dr. Budenthal just called them, supervised injection facilities. These are all the same basic places. And they can be standalone sites, that they can be mobile sites, they can be part of a larger site. There's really a lot of different iterations of these. And they have existed globally for 35 years now, or since the 80s. And they're currently in over 200 cities in the world, and in 15 countries in Europe, Australia, Canada, and the U.S. As well. So what are these sites trying to solve? What's the problem they're trying to solve? Where are we at with this? Well, there's a few different things that sort of have led us to having these kinds of sites. The first is that people who overdose while using drugs alone are most likely to die from an overdose, right? There's no one there to save them, revive them, you know, act upon it in any kind of way. So you don't want people using alone. And even if people do use with others, overdose reversal requires someone to either have a naloxone and to be able to use it and want to use it. You know, there's a lot of things that need to happen right then and there. And so what these overdose prevention sites provide is a place to go where someone's going to actively look at you, and someone who's trained in how to save you in case you overdose. So that's the sort of the problem that you're trying to get through there. But there's also the other piece, which is that, you know, public drug use is a big piece of the puzzle as well. So lots of people are using publicly. That's uncomfortable for both the people who are using drugs. They don't want to be doing that in front of a family walking down the streets, or maybe afraid their police is going to come or something like that. But also for the people who have to witness it. Nobody wants to see someone using drugs in the streets or something like that. And so these are places where you can go out of the public eye of people to use drugs as well. So it gets people off of the streets. And then connecting people to needed social and health services, including drug treatment, is expensive to do. How do you get them in? How do you link them? You can have outreach workers everywhere. It's tough to get people in various places. And so this is also a place where you have an catchment area where people are already coming to you. And so then you can add other services or link people to other kinds of things as well. And then the other piece of it is also just kind of the sanctuary piece that these places provide, because, you know, the streets, there's a lot of violence, robbery, there's a lot of things of exhaustion from people being out there. So it solves some of the homeless, or temporarily, or at moments where they're here, it's a place of respite as well. So where are we at with the current landscape of OPS in the United States? So essentially, And I'm going to be talking about most of these and showing some of the evaluations today of most of these. But the first is really the unsanctioned overdose prevention site was that was in an unnamed city somewhere in the United States between 2014 and 2020. There were some other documented and still are some undocumented unsanctioned OPS also in the U.S. The first government sanctioned site opened on November 30th, 2021, so pretty much 3 years ago, by On Point in New York City, and that's still open. So that's been open for almost 3 years, and there's really two sites there, one in Harlem and one up in Washington Heights. And then the only other government sanctioned site was the one in San Francisco, which I'll talk quite a bit about today as well, that existed for about 11 months downtown and on Market Street in San Francisco. And then from a policy perspective, Rhode Island State Legislature sanctioned overdose prevention sites now maybe 3 years ago, I want to say, 2-3 years ago. And they're finally going to open their first site in Providence this fall, hopefully the next month or so, I think I'm being told, which will be interesting to see. And then the state of Minnesota last year also sanctioned overdose prevention sites, but they don't have any sites that are kind of actively in planning or something like that that we know about that are coming up there. And then there are still other U.S. cities that are in various stages of doing it this other way. And you really have two different ways. You have a legislative way of doing this, and then you have just a city saying, we're just going to do it. And so those are two very different things. They have benefits and drawbacks, each of them. The legislative one is good because then it's not sort of, you know, it's not up to a mayor, or you have a change in a mayor or a change in ideas about mayors. That's got some problems with it, but it's also much flexible. You can just sort of decide to do it right away, right? Legislation, you know, it takes longer to do. And often then they legislate the kinds of rules and regulations that perhaps sites don't really want to do or aren't optimal for where they are as well. So there's some problems with the legislative sites as well, but there's a sort of the two different ways that that were two avenues really towards getting overdose prevention sites in the U.S. So I'm going to go on to talk about the science piece, but before I do, any questions so far about what overdose prevention sites are, where we're at, anything about that yet, either in the room or online? Yes.
My quick question is the and so when it's sanctioned, it just means that they look the other way, right? It's still technically illegal.
Yeah.
But they just unenforced. Got it.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just unenforced. Yeah. So. You know, we don't technically know if these sites are illegal federally because there hasn't been a lawsuit against them per se. There hasn't been anything that's actually actively happened there. But there are aspects of them that are. There's a couple of different laws that are important here. One is what they call the crack house statutes, which actually Biden was the one to introduce in the late 1980s, which is that if you know that there's drug use happening in your in a place that you own, then they can basically seize that plow. So if you have a house and you know people are using drugs in it, they can come and seize it, take the house from you, essentially. So here we know that there's drug use happening in these sites, and so that's potentially going against that. Now, the argument there is potentially is that the law wasn't intended for public health purposes. It was this sort of like, oh, people are just using drugs on the street in this house. We want to be able to do something about that. So would the law, we don't know. It hasn't been tested yet. So would the law go against that or not? We don't really know. And the other would be the Controlled Substances Act, which is, you know, now 50 years old or a little over 50 years old. And that is, you know, you're not allowed to use these drugs. All states. Back now that Oregon has recriminalized as of September 1. But it is technically probably illegal, both federally and from state, for most of these states. So they're looking the other, it's part of that sort of cycle of looking the blind eye towards it. Yes?
I have a question online. This is from Dr. Rosalie Pakula from the Schaefer Center. While the U.S. has been slow to open overdose prevention sites, other countries have had them for a bit longer. Are lessons from those relevant for the U.S., or do key differences in drug markets influence the generalizability?
Yeah, that's a good question. Hopefully I can maybe answer that more with going through some of the science here, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through kind of quickly the global evidence for these, and then I'm going to go through the US evidence for this. And the answer is going to be, at the end of the day, is that you're going to see the exact same results globally and in the US. So in that sense, we both can learn from them, and it seems like they have the same effects here that elsewhere. And I know when it gets to drug policy and a lot of other policies in the U.S., there's this sort of U.S. exceptionalism that, like, oh, yeah, this works in Europe, but it could never work here in the U.S. because we're very, very different. And I don't want to minimize the fact that there are huge differences, especially in terms of how healthcare is delivered or who pays for healthcare in Canada or many of those Northern European countries compared to the U.S. But that's sort of the payment piece of it. If you do these sites, they pretty much look the same, and they basically seem to act the same both in the U.S. as they do elsewhere.
You're listening to Alex Krall, PhD, a distinguished fellow, Behavioral Health and Criminal Justice at RTI International, giving a presentation entitled Overdose Prevention Sites, Global and Domestic Research, Policy, and Implementation, which was part of the Institute for Addiction Sciences speaker series. We'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear more about safe consumption sites from Alex Krall, PhD.
What we found was that people really liked the one-stop shopping part, that they could go there and get all these kinds of services taken care of in various different ways. And it created a space for community building. They had, you know, they had karaoke there. They had a lot of different kinds of things. Music was always kind of blasting, and people were having fun, and people were really building a community. And a lot of people who are out and about, they don't have that. And this is a space like, oh, we're all here together. They're making friends. They're making connections, meaningful connections with both people and staff there. It was really important. And then, they talked a lot about offering safety and a respite for guests. And I one thing that was kind of interesting on this part was this one woman I remember that we interviewed. And she said, you know, one of the things I like about this the most is that when I'm here, I don't have to save anyone from overdose. Like, I don't have to take that responsibility. When I'm out there, I'm always got naloxone with me, and like, I'm always looking around, and I'm like, I gotta like be, you know, worried about, you know, do I need to save people? What do I need to do here in some sort of way? And this is a place where she felt like she could just be and have the professionals take care of this piece. And I think that that's what the added piece regarding a respite, I think, was an important one for them. There were 333 overdoses during this 11 months on site. Nobody died. And you can see this is sort of by week, the number of overdoses, and those things do fluctuate, often because of really drug market pieces. And will it bring people in from other places? Well, for a couple of months, they did a thing where they basically asked every person who came from what neighborhood they came from. 94% of them were from the Tenderloin, which is right then and there. 2% from the adjacent neighborhood, also the other adjacent neighborhood to there. They weren't coming from anywhere else. So they were basically coming from right down there. And then the last piece we did was what we call systematic observations around the TLC. So basically what we did again was we took a 500 meter radius around the center. And then we had a comparison site, the Mission Neighborhood Resource Center, which is a center for people who are experiencing homelessness, and they have a medical clinic there and all kinds of things as well, as a comparison. And then what we did was we had two research assistants come and walk every single block, and they had a tablet to basically record information on to see what they saw on the blocks. We had expected there was going to be one of these sites opening in the city already in 2018. And so we started doing these in 2018 and 2019, but no site sort of came up. And then, you know, as luck should have it, when they placed the site, they literally placed it about a block from where it is that we had assumed there would be a site at a future time. And so we actually had pre-data and post-data then for both of this data. We collected things like, you know, do you see people smoking drugs or injecting drugs or selling drugs on this block? You see, you know, needles on the streets, those sorts of things. Also homelessness issues. Are you bringing more homeless people to this area or not? So visible human excrement, people sleeping, tents, those kinds of things we looked at as well. And so what you see here for this data is then the pre-data, which is 2018 and 2019, and then the 2022 data is basically 6 months after this opened, but it's all during the time that this was open here. The bottom line is the control neighborhood, and what you see there is about as flat a line as you possibly can. Basically, the amount of blocks, the percentage of blocks that had these kinds of things at them was completely, did not change over these three time periods. But at the top, you see the red one, and actually what you see between 2018 and 2019 is it was actually steadily increasing in this neighborhood, these kinds of, you know, drug-related and homeless-related things on the blocks. But then you see at the 2022, again, it came down, and that was statistically significant that it actually came down by then as well. So it's certainly, again, not making things worse in the neighborhood and possibly making them better. So summarizing the findings from this then, 333 overdoses, no deaths, right? This is the data we see no matter where we go, wherever you are in the world, this is what you see. On average, 18,000 hours, you know, that people are not on the street. I think that's per month. That's a lot. The model was certainly appealing to guests. And, you know, people will use these sites in San Francisco, and co-locating these other services was something that's important in terms of both reducing barriers, but also connecting people to the kinds of support that they need. There was a sizable need for these sites. They could, I think from a lot of our work there, talking to some, we interviewed staff quite a lot, they could use more support to improve staff wellness. I think that's it's tough to work in these places doing this work. You are bearing witness to a lot of trauma. And so that's an important thing to think about here. The drug use and improperly discarded equipment, you know, was basically the same and even potentially lower as it was in 2019 before that. So our recommendations for this was to open more of these sites, co-locate them with other kinds of services, increase staffing and capacity for this, provide ongoing de-escalation training for employees, implement same-day debriefs too. And I think a lot of people talked about how, you know, things happen. There's like an average of one overdose a day at the site. Having a debrief at the end of the day and having people check in was something that people were really looking for at the time. Some inventory. I mean, they couldn't sort of keep enough oxygen there for a time, and so they needed to improve some of that as well. Hosting listening sessions with guests about their feedback, because they certainly had feedback, and they gave us a lot of that feedback as well. There's a protocol that was in place that basically required, the city required them to call 911 for every overdose, which is just not necessary in any kind of way, because people are being revived right then and there. Creating an opportunity for guests to participate as volunteered or paid workers was also something that was brought up, and we thought that was an important thing to add to it. So I'm going to just conclude the last couple of little things. I did say I was going to look at cost effectiveness. There have been some studies of this around the U.S. and San Francisco. We did one where we basically found that if you placed, and this is at the time, if you placed one like they had in Vancouver, exactly the same kind of site, but with the dollars and things going on and staffing in San Francisco, it would essentially have a net savings of $3.5 million a year. So that's amazing. Baltimore did a similar analysis showing almost an $8 million annual savings. And Providence, they compared an OPS to, if you open an OPS to a syringe service program, and found it would be $1 million in savings compared to that. And then New York also did similar kinds of analyses, looking at both one site, or if they had four sites at one point, between $1 million and up to even $6 million dollars would be saved. So just to summarize, the science is rigorous. It is extensive. Every peer-reviewed paper out there has found positive impact and no negative impact. of these sites, both on the people who use them and in the places where they're placed. I think that's pretty tough to say. I mean, all of you who are working in substance use, addiction, and all that, like, how many interventions can we say that for? Can we say that for methadone? Can we say it for, I mean, what can we say that for, really? You're going to have negative studies on both sides, but here there hasn't been any negative studies, and I think that's remarkable.
That was Alex Kral, PhD, a Distinguished Fellow, Behavioral Health and Criminal Justice at RTI International, giving a presentation entitled Overdose Prevention Sites, Global and Domestic Research, Policy and Implementation, as part of the Institute for Addiction Sciences speaker series. There was time for some Q&A at the end. Here's a bit from that.
Given the documented success of the San Francisco OPS program, I'm just sort of curious what the political backlash was, particularly given the homelessness issue in San Francisco. One would think that there'd be an emphasis on these kind of evidence-based programs.
There are a lot of things that one would think. you know, one of the things we wanted to do, because, I think from a policy perspective, you really have two issues here. You have people overdose and people dying of overdose. I mean, that's a big one. And the other, this public drug use piece that nobody wants as well, which is why we really wanted to do that sort of time study piece to show that we're getting people off of the streets for a certain amount of, you know, here was 18,000 hours a month. And that's something you'd think that everybody would be pro that. Like, who wouldn't want that in some sort of way? You know, politics are tricky. The mayor made some decisions up front, which was, you know, when the psych center decided to, they were going to open this up, she had a quick decision to make. And I can't speak to how she made that decision or what she would have made that or why she would, but she decided to let it go on, which was basically what she had a decision to make, whether to do that or not. But she basically put a gag order on everyone working there such that they let it go on, but no one could talk about it. No journalists, no nothing. It's just as if it wasn't happening. Well, you know, here you are on Market Street, right next to a BART station, a subway station, with a fence that's a temporary fence that you can't see behind. And you've got a lineup of people who look like they're probably experiencing homelessness. What's going on behind the fence? What's up? Can't tell you. Well, you know, that lack of transparency, I think, is a big problem. You got ambulances coming because there's overdoses and stuff. The lack of transparency, I think, made the public and the neighborhood really nervous about what was going on. What are you hiding? Something bad. So rather than owning it and saying, this is something that's a public health service, yeah, we realize maybe it's controversial, but we're going to do it. Which is how they did it in New York. They literally had journalists and police at their site the day they opened. Anyone can come anytime, and they put a lot of resources on. They have groups. If any of you want to go there, you can sign up online and go for a group, and you can go in and see it. They're like, we're completely transparent what we're doing here. And I think that lack of transparency, I think, created a backlash against it, such that it was no longer a tenable situation politically.
That was Alex Kral, PhD, a Distinguished Fellow, Behavioral Health and Criminal Justice at RTI International, giving a presentation entitled Overdose Prevention Sites, Global and Domestic Research, Policy and Implementation, as part of the Institute for Addiction Sciences speaker series. And for now, that's it. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long. Just a soul's intentions.